My name is Brian Paul. I'm a attorney at Ice Miller and the president of the local lawyers chapter of the Federalist Society. Thank you all for being here. Today's topic of discussion is environmental law. Now, you might be asking yourself, that's an awfully specialized area of law. Why are we holding a Federalist Society event on environmental law? What next? Admiralty? Bankruptcy? No and no, and definitely no. But there is a good reason we're having a program on environmental law. According to a report in 2012 by the Heritage Foundation, during the first 3 years of the Obama administration, 106 new major federal regulations added more than $46 billion per year in new costs for Americans. Perhaps not surprisingly, some of the most expensive and, depending on your perspective, troubling regulations were issued by the Environmental Protection Agency. Among the new major regulations were stricter limits on industrial and commercial boilers and incinerators, and more stringent controls on emissions from coal-fired power plants. But lest you think that the EPA is only targeting business, the EPA has also issued more stringent energy conservation standards for refrigerators, freezers, furnaces, and air conditioners, all things that just about all of us have in all of our homes. And to top it off, there are many new major environmental regulations in the works. So environmental law is, in fact, extremely important, and it is worthy of our discussion. Here to discuss a particular aspect of environmental law, and in particular the role of deference in deciding environmental disputes, is Professor John Nagel. Professor Nagel is a professor of law at Notre Dame Law School, where he's been teaching since 1998. He's the author of several books on environmental law, including a casebook on the subject. His other writings have explored such topics as the relationship between environmental pollution and cultural pollution, the role of religion in environmental law, Chinese environmental law. Do they have environmental laws? And the scope of congressional power to protect endangered species. Therefore, you wouldn't be surprised that Professor Nagel also teaches a number of courses related to environmental law, legislation, and property. He has lectured on these issues and numerous others in the United States and outside of the United States. Today, the title of Professor Nagel's talk is From Hubris to Humility, Who Should Make Decisions About Environmental Law? Please welcome Professor Nagel.
Well, thanks so much for being here. It's not often I get to talk about my lifelong passion for admiralty law. I love coming to Indianapolis just because it's such, you know, I'm an IU undergrad. My dad went to Purdue. I went to Michigan for law school. I'm at Notre Dame. I've got something to upset everyone when I'm here. So, but it really is, it's a lot of fun. And if nothing else, I particularly appreciate, you know, having a kind of locked-in distraction to keep me from grading at least for a little while longer, since my property exams aren't quite done, but I'm getting close. But I am going to talk about environmental law today. And let me start with this. I mean, the conceit of environmental law is that it operates on the assumption that it knows what the ideal environment is. And that's why we have environmental law. So if you look at, you know, our national environmental policy, which often we don't spend much time looking at because there's no real legal force to it, but NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, is most famous for environmental impact statements on federal projects and things like that. But its initial sections, in which what the framers kind of expected to be quite important sections, state a national environmental policy. And I'm not going to kind of rehearse that whole thing now, but it talks about kind of, you know, trying to reduce pollution, trying to preserve land and wildlife, and trying to ensure that people and the rest of creation can live in harmony, and all kind of generic platitudes, which, you know, which are worthwhile, but from a legal perspective really aren't operational. But if you look further environmental law, if you look at, say, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, you'll see that they're very precise commands about what kind of environment we want, how much pollution we're willing to tolerate, what kinds of development and where we're allowed to development, be it in wetlands or wildlife habitat or things like that. And so the whole kind of range of environmental statutes, not just the federal ones that get the most attention, but state law, local zoning ordinances, even in some aspects international regulation, all are kind of based on this assumption that we need the law to tell us what the environment should be like. Okay? But what should the environment be like? Okay? One of the things I've been trying to do, both in my classes and some of my research, is to try to figure out what is the ideal environment? What are the ideal conditions? And I think without going through all that discussion, there is no single answer to it. You know, it's not as if you can simply say this is the perfect kind of environment, whether it's one which is a developed city or whether it's one which is a wilderness area or something like that. We don't want just one answer to that question. We want a kind of range, a real pluralistic approach to that question. But that then leads to the kind of further challenge, again, which we see a lot in the law, is who gets to make the decision. Who do we entrust with the power under the law to decide what the law should be like, or what the environment should be like? And if you look at environmental law, broadly speaking, you'll see that we have a whole host of answers to that question. Sometimes we say it's scientific experts get to decide what the environment's going to be like. Sometimes it's administrative experts. Sometimes it's the president. Sometimes, as with the current kind of permitting process with respect to the Keystone Pipeline, it's the Secretary of State, oddly enough. Sometimes Congress makes these decisions. Federal judges, state governments, local governments, the people as a whole. But you can look at different ways in which all of these different actors, all of us in all these different capacities, are empowered to make these decisions about what the environment should be like. And if you pull all that together, what you see is that the conflicts about environmental law are often about who gets to make that decision. That many environmental law disputes are really about who's best equipped to make environmental policy. So who is best equipped to make environmental policy? Well, the traditional answer was that we didn't need the government to intervene in this, that we would just do this, that farmers and landowners and businesses and individuals would just kind of go about their business. They could cut down forests and grow crops. They could, you know, set aside land for hunting. They could build a city, whatever it might happen to be. And you could just do that. And you could do one thing. Your neighbor could do something else. One town could emphasize one thing. Another town could emphasize something else. And the whole premise was that we'd end up something which we're all satisfied with. Okay? And in a sense, you still see a lot of that today, and I would say rightly so. That as kind of intrusive as environmental regulation can be, there still is a wide range of things, decisions we make which affect the environment, which are our decisions. Okay. Now, there's a lot of others that aren't, don't get me wrong. But the kind of way that's been translated into this era of environmental law is through this idea of free market environmentalism, that, you know, we should rely upon market forces to provide the incentives and the disincentives to people to decide what, you know, what factories to build, what kind of pollution is tolerable, what, you know, kind of how all these decisions make place. And collectively, this idea is that free market environmentalism, the claim is going to actually be more effective in caring for the environment in the sense of providing the environment that we want than a regime of government control. Okay, now there are two parts to that claim. First is the idea that actually if you look at what people will do, if you give them property rights, they will take actions which are in the interests of their property, which means they're not going to ruin their land, they're not going to ruin the resource which they have, you know, which they own. Okay? Because if they do so, if they allow overgrazing, to use the kind of classic tragedy of the commons example, if they, you know, to take all the nutrients out of the land, if they, you know, pollute the water upon which they depend for irrigation or drinking or whatever it is, they'll suffer the consequences. So in that respect, the idea is that if there is a property right attached, the people will do what's in their interest and not harm, you know, their own property. Okay? And even where there's not a property right attached, the fact that there's such a kind of growing environmental ethic, something which I see just using, you know, the example of my daughters in high school right now. They went to a small Christian school, not likely to be kind of indoctrinated by kind of radical, you know, Al Gore was not a featured speaker at my daughter's school, let's just say. They're interested in this stuff. You know, they don't want, you know, they're, you know, for better or worse, my older daughter really doesn't want the Deli Sands flower-loving fly to go extinct, to use one example of an endangered fly of all things, which has impeded development in Southern California. Wholly apart from the Endangered Species Act and the law and all those sorts of things, there's a kind of idea that we don't want to do this. And if that's animating private decisions, then you don't need the law to kind of intervene in that respect as well. So that's the first part of the free market environmentalism claim. The second part is that even if it's not perfect, and of course it's not, you have to have a pretty kind of lively imagination to think that government regulation is going to solve all our problems. That you can look back and see all sorts of examples of the government trying to do something with respect to the environment that ends up having all sorts of untoward and unintended consequences. And in fact, a book that I wrote just 3 years ago called Law's Environment, this is about five case studies of places around the country, very different places, very different issues, stretching from the Aleutians to the Susquehanna River to Alamogordo, New Mexico. I was just interested in looking at environmental law from the perspective of not tracing one law all around the country, how's the Clean Air Act work here, 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 but rather, in this one place, what is the combination of laws and other forces that affects what the environment's actually like there? And I had no idea what I'd find. I just thought it was an interesting perspective on it. But what I found repeatedly was that it didn't work the way we intended. That the consequences of the, quote, environmental laws never quite worked just the right way. Other laws, which weren't the environmental laws, ended up having a tremendous impact on the environment, whether it's the siting of a highway or a military base or something like that. And just kind of the norms of the community end up affecting those kind of decisions as well. So there, the unintended consequences kind of theme is really kind of prominent here. And then there's other instances where the government actually achieves what it wants to do, but it turns out what it wants to do wasn't such a great idea after all. Okay? And there's all sorts of examples of that throughout environmental history that you can kind of think of. So the idea is that, you know, to simply assume that we have to have the law to solve environmental problems is just naive. But on the other hand, as someone who grew up in Pittsburgh, was talking about this earlier, and I was born in 1960, the worst of the air pollution was actually behind us at that point, but I heard stories from my father, from others. It was pretty nasty, okay? And there's all sorts of reasons why it's so much better now, okay? And market forces, you know, business, you know, steel going to work, going to China, what all sorts of things, but undoubtedly environmental regulations played a part in that, because there was a sense that the steel factories, for example, had that pollution was just the cost of doing business. There's actually historical literature which suggests that people thought that the pollution was kind of desirable. It kind of added to the kind of, you know, it showed we were making progress. Exactly. Okay. See the same thing, my wife's family's from Butte, Montana, and similar kind of circumstance there. You know, people actually like this. It shows progress. Well, it also killed people. And so the fact that we're able now to not have cities that have that kind of pollution, to not have the Great Lakes, to use the example I talked about earlier, which when I visited as a kid in the 60s were just nasty, and now we go swimming there every summer. That's not only due to the fact that we have regulation, but it's partly due to that. Okay, so I guess what I'm in a short way of trying to say is that the idea that we can do a lot of what we want to do environmentally without the law is an important one, but we can't do it completely without the law. But let's look at the other extreme. Okay, so if we can't produce the ideal environment through our individual actions, then there are those who say that, well, we have to entrust everything to the coercive power of the state. Okay. So that environmental law presumes that legal constraints are necessary to achieve our environmental goals. And taken to its kind of extreme, which it has been taken to, what you find are that we should aspire to be China for the day, which is actually the title of a chapter in a book Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, wrote a few years ago, where he basically said that that he's not a fan of China's system of government generally. Quite a striking concession, I realize. But he did say that there was one aspect of China's government that he found appealing, which was the ability of China's leaders to kind of cut through all the special interests, the legacy industries, the bureaucratic obstacles, the fears of voter backlash, and simply order something to happen. Okay? So when I was in, I taught in Beijing for a semester in 2002, and China had been awarded the Olympics for 2008 already by then, and they were trying to get Beijing ready. Okay? So what do? Well, they order all of the coal-fired factories and utilities out of the city, period. Okay? Imagine what that would be like here. You know, we'd be employed for years if the government just kind of ordered that. Okay? But there are no citizen suits. There's no petitions to review. There's no D.C. circuit. There's none of this stuff in China. Okay? They order it. It happens. Deal with it. Okay? That's essentially how it works there. Now, to be fair, China is actually trying to kind of work there. That's what I was doing there on a Fulbright, both in Beijing and then in Hong Kong a few years later. And they understand the issue, but they're unwilling, quite literally, to say that the government can be held accountable under the law. So that, yeah, there is Chinese environmental law, and it actually looks pretty good on paper. What there isn't is Chinese administrative law in the sense that we're used to, where you can hold the government to account under the law. That's what's missing, okay? Well, Thomas Friedman, he's not that naive. He understands that. So that's why he only wants to be China for a day. Because he says if we could just kind of cut through all the tape, we can get all the rules in place, then we'll go back and put the democracy in place and make sure that we can kind of work that way. So he calls his chapter actually China for a day, but not for two. But the idea that there are people who are interested in environmental progress, however they define it, who actually envy China is a bit chilling. And in fact, it's not just Friedman. You know, there's a kind of this whole sense of authoritarian chic, as some have called it, which is kind of, you can find different kind of writers, not lots, but there's enough to kind of give you pause, which try to say that's what we need. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to try to rebut that because I think it's kind of self-evident what a lot of the issues are with that. But the mere fact that there is a strain in thinking which suggests that the way to solve environmental problems is simply to give the government literally all the power is something that's out there, okay? And not just in China, because you see that here, okay? Well, why is that so bad at the same time that simply relying upon individual decision-making isn't necessarily fully satisfactory either? And as I've really worked through this, the one thing that kind of kept coming to my mind about this is the idea of humility, okay? That while environmental law, in one sense, is the antithesis of humility because it's telling someone you have to do this, we have the answer in the law, okay? But even with that understood, you can make the law more humble. Okay? You can recognize we have different ideas of what the ideal environment should be, and we have different ideas of how should we can achieve that. It recognizes that I'll know some things and you'll know some things, that the kind of diffused idea of power and knowledge actually is a benefit rather than a burden. And in particular, one of the kind of implications of humility, just kind of generally understood, is deference. I mean, to be humble in many respects is to defer to someone else, okay? Not unthinkingly, not, you know, kind of, you know, a kind of false humility which says, oh, I don't know anything, when in fact you do, okay? But we're so prone to exaggerate our own understandings and our own abilities and to discount those of others that humility is kind of the cautionary note. Humility is the idea that, you know, someone else really might know the answer to that. They might have a better way to deal with that kind of thing. And so if that's the case, you want to defer to them. And sure enough, environmental law in particular has a lot to do with deference. Okay. In fact, if you kind of look at a lot of strains in environmental law and try to figure out what's the answer to the question of who should decide, the kind of ubiquitous rule of deference suggests that the answer is, well, somebody else should. Okay? That, you know, courts are deferred to agencies, agencies defer to scientists, Congress comes into play. There's all sorts of ideas for deference here, okay? But you can't only defer because it's like, you know, kind of, you know, I'll do it. No, you do it. No, I'll do it. No, I mean, someone has to make a decision under the law. And that's what these rules are designed to get at. So deference is kind of fundamental in three particular ways in environmental law, but it's fundamental in a kind of evolving way. Let me just describe each. First is the idea that we need to defer to scientific evidence. Okay? And this is an idea that's built on the understanding that a lot of environmental law requires an understanding of the environment. Is that substance, when it's in the air or the water, harmful or beneficial? Okay? Is that stuff that's been buried underground for five decades a threat or not? Okay? Is, you know, that bird over there in danger of going extinct? Those kinds of questions. Science, you know, is necessary to be able to provide the factual answers to those questions. And recognizing that, you see a lot of federal environmental laws, and state and local laws for that matter, which require decisions to be made based on the science, and sometimes only based on the science. So when EPA sets the National Ambient Air Quality Standards that say how much of the kind of the six main pollutants are allowed throughout the country, it does that solely on the base of science, both the Act and the Supreme Court has subsequently told us, not based on how much it would cost to achieve those standards or anything like that. It's purely, you know, at what point would exposure to this pollution harm people? Okay, scientific question, no other evidence allowed. Or the Endangered Species Act says in determining whether or not to list a species as endangered or threatened, which then automatically triggers all the kinds of restrictions on development that the Act does, that's only a scientific question. Is the species in danger of going extinct or not? Okay. Once you know the answer to that, then we can have debates about, you know, what the consequences of that are, but that is only a scientific question. And Congress set it up that way in the statutes. It's plain on the face of those statutes and some others that science isn't just a factor, it's the only factor. There are other statutes in which it's a factor. With that in mind, then when the agencies entrusted with making those decisions, EPA sets the NAAQS and the Fish and Wildlife Service kind of decides about the species or something, judges then are told to defer to the agency's understanding of the science. Okay? So whereas the agency is supposed to defer to the scientists, now the judges are supposed to defer to the agency. Generally, because we expect the agencies to have greater scientific understanding than the judges, which is generally true. Not always. Okay, there are going to be some clueless agency officials, and there'll be some quite knowledgeable judges, but as a general matter, that's true. And so, just for one example, last year the First Circuit decided a case involving water pollution from a sewage treatment plant along the Blackstone River in central Massachusetts. This is a river which had been heavily polluted from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you know, textile mills, and then heavy metals from industrial waste and all sorts of things. That's been cleaned up, but now the biggest threat to the water quality is kind of the release of all the stuff from the sewage treatment plants and the kind of what that's doing with respect to nitrogen, phosphorus, you know, the treatment of that kind of stuff. And so EPA imposed a kind of a regulatory requirement on the publicly owned treatment work, which that, you know, municipal treatment work didn't think was appropriate and argued about the science, said that it wasn't justified. And so it starts making arguments about, you know, kind of how much we can trust an article with the title of Eutrophication Patterns of a Mesocosm Experiment, published in the Marine Ecology Progress series. I've read that article. I have no idea what it says. Okay? And that's more or less what the First Circuit said. Because what the the sewage treatment plant was arguing was, well, they got this wrong. The agency misunderstood that, and it's been outdated and all these sorts of things. And EPA had responses to them. They obviously weren't satisfying to the treatment plant. But what the First Circuit said was that we're not going to sit here and say that the EPA misunderstood the science on this to the extent that their rule is invalidated. Sure, it can't be arbitrary and capricious, and it doesn't appear to be, but the mere fact that there's another scientific opinion isn't cause for overturning it. In other words, we'll defer to the agency in that context. And so they did. And so the sewage treatment plant has to kind of deal with it and somehow find a way to satisfy that. And that seems kind of like an entirely logical and appropriate kind of position. And I think there's a lot to be said for it. On the other hand, I think there are certainly instances in which it can be critiqued as going too far. So Emily Mazel is actually a professor at Wake Forest now, wrote a piece in the Columbia Law Review a few years ago, kind of critiquing this, which she described as super deference in these kinds of contexts. And she says it's appealing, it's supported by basic notions of institutional competence, natural judicial tendency to avoid any deep confrontations with science, all kinds of obvious things like that. But then she goes on to say that, you know, that it really is in tension with the idea that courts are reinforcing administrative law values like participation, transparency, deliberation, kind of what the APA says to do, as well as the idea that you don't want to simply give an agency a license to kind of do whatever it wants under the guise of, under the language of science. And so there's some kind of interesting debates going on, I think, within some of the courts and more so in some of the academic debates about that kind of deference. But it's plainly something which, you know, makes sense. It's the idea that you don't want judges kind of pretending to know the answer to these things. You know, the one example I can offer from my own experience, before I taught, I was in the Justice Department, and I argued a case in the D.C. Circuit once involving a cleanup of a Superfund site. I can't remember where this was. I was in Miami. And there was a real question about how these chemicals were interacting, and it was kind of going on. And at some point, I had no clue. I'm up there representing EPA, but I can't answer these questions. Thankfully, in that circumstance, thankfully for me, thankfully for the court and everyone else, I was able to kind of leave the podium for a minute, let the EPA counsel stand up for about 3 minutes, answer those specific technical questions. He sat down, I got back. All was well. Okay? But it just kind of shows that, and ultimately, those questions were kind of irrelevant. You know, the judge didn't even rely on them. The court didn't even rely on them. But it shows they didn't even know what the question, I mean, it's just so hard to try to make sense of that kind of thing that deference is especially appropriate there. Second time of deference. Chevron. Okay, that's kind of the familiar idea that's really only 30 years old, that courts will defer to reasonable an agency's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute. But that also means that agencies have to defer to clear statements in a statute that Congress has enacted. So in that respect, Chevron has kind of deference flowing two ways. Like it or not, with respect to what the agency wants to accomplish as a policy objective, the agency has to defer to the statute. If the statute says that you allow this, you don't allow this, it has to be done this way, you've got to do it that way. Okay? There's no wiggle room if you've got plain meaning, if you've satisfied the first step of Chevron. The agency has to interpret or has to defer to what Congress said. It's not a generalized license for the agency to solve the problem. They have to do so in the way that Congress said so. So that's the agency deferring to Congress. But if the statute is ambiguous, Chevron tells us, then the court is supposed to defer to the agency with respect to its interpretation of the statute on the assumption that the agency is better equipped, is implicitly entrusted by Congress to make these kind of interstitial policy decisions that aren't resolved by the statute, that the agency can be trusted, and we should defer to the agency to make that decision about the meaning of the statute so long as the statute is ambiguous and so long as the agency at least reasonably interprets it. That's Chevron step two. Okay. Well, in the 30 years since Chevron was decided, it's generated an enormous amount of literature. It's generated an enormous amount of case law. The summary of that, as best I can tell from having taught it and done a few and kind of doing some of this research in the last couple of months, plainly it's been narrowed over the years, especially by the Mead decision, which the court said that there has to be this kind of specific indication that this agency has the power to interpret this statute. So it's not a generalized deference to agency interpretations. It's still a little bit unclear exactly what counts as a kind of plain, kind of what counts under Chevron step one. Is there a clear statement? Is there a plain meaning? Can you look to the legislative history? Can you look to the policy? What actually, is it just a textual inquiry? There's not a lot. There's some unevenness in the way that's been dealt with in the lower courts and even on the Supreme Court as well. And there still actually is a pretty robust kind of scholarly debate about the whole idea of Chevron deference still going on, you know, within the law reviews. And, you know, sometimes that doesn't seem to affect things. This one does. It does seem that the courts are kind of tweaking their understanding of how this works in particular cases based upon some of this discussion. So the rule is clear, okay? But on the margins, exactly how it plays out is still kind of up for grabs. But it means that, again, we have deference. Deference that the courts provide to the agency, because the courts aren't the experts on that, but also deference that the agency has to pay to Congress. That's the second kind of deference. The third and last kind of deference that I'll talk about is one where, you know, where there's a rule that says that the courts will defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of the agency's own regulations. Okay, so agency has a statute, it's responsible for implementing, it promulgates a regulation, case arises about the meaning of that regulation, and under what's variously called the Seminole Rock or the Auer Doctrine, Auer Deference, A-U-E-R, two different cases in the Supreme Court, the idea is that just as the courts are supposed to defer to agencies' interpretations of statutes, they're also supposed to defer to agencies' reasonable interpretations of ambiguous regulations, okay? And that actually was kind of reaffirmed just in a case a couple of months ago, Decker versus Northwest Environmental Defense Center. Question was whether Georgia Pacific's logging operations in a state forest in Oregon required a federal Clean Water Act permit. It was thought to raise a lot of questions about the scope of the statute itself. And then just 3 days before a lower argument, EPA came out with a regulation which essentially exempted the logging operations like those at issue in Decker. I think it's fair to say the court, particularly the Chief Justice, was miffed that the whole premise of the case changed 3 days before the oral argument. But they proceeded to decide it and ended up deferring that, so the new regulation resolved anything going forward, but there was still an issue about possible remedies for people under the old regulation, so they had to resolve that dispute. And the court said that it would defer to EPA's interpretation of its original regulation, which was ambiguous, under this Auer Doctrine, okay? And so, you know, it stood. 8 members of the court agreed with that. Justice Scalia, though, dissented on the interpretive issue, and he would have overruled that deference doctrine because he said it's fundamentally really different from Chevron, that whereas Chevron is deferring to what Congress has said and now in the assumption that the agency is entrusted with the ambiguity, that's not the case here. So if the idea is that the agency has any special expertise in knowing kind of what this regulation means, well, only if you view the task of interpretation as literally going back and asking the people who wrote it, what do you mean, which isn't what we do with legislation necessarily. And he goes on to say that the agency's technical expertise, another justification for deferring to its interpretations of regulation, that technical expertise explains why we allow agencies to promulgate regulations, but it doesn't also say that they should have the power to interpret them. The biggest problem, Justice Scalia said, was that it violates the fundamental, not just separation of powers, but really rule of law principle, that he who writes a law must not adjudge its violation. In other words, we don't want to be like China, okay? Because that's really the Chinese system, okay? They write the laws, they implement the laws, they judge the laws, same person. No separation of powers, okay? So he's kind of laid this out there. Chief Justice Roberts kind of wryly noted in a concurrence that, you know, that this wasn't the case to decide this. The bar is on notice that this issue is now out there, and, you know, one of the positions has been well briefed by Justice Scalia. As it happens, there are also competing groups of law professors who had kind of argued for or against this kind of deference as well. So it's quite likely that this issue is going to go back. That whether or not this kind of deference is appropriate or not is something which the court never fully explained when it started with this, you know, kind of doctrine, and now is probably going to have to decide it again. One other thing to mention about that is even though these are deferential doctrines, there are lots of cases where deference isn't afforded because the court concludes the statute under Chevron or the regulation under our is clear. And so you can't do something contrary to that. There was actually a Sixth Circuit case last year about Clean Air Act regulation of a natural gas sweetening plant and wells in Michigan, where the plant was located in one place, and there's about 100 wells anywhere from 500 yards to 8 miles away. And the question, whether or not, it's actually kind of a reverse Chevron issue, because Chevron itself, the company, wanted to be able to treat kind of connected facilities as one and for purposes of what came under the scope of the air pollution regulation. In this Michigan case, the company wanted them separate because if you could aggregate them, they'd actually collectively reach the threshold at which point regulation was required under the Clean Air Act. So the companies said they're separate and individually they're under the threshold. EPA said that they could be aggregated, so they'd not be subject to regulation. The EPA decision said that they satisfied the regulatory requirement that the wells were adjacent to each other. Okay? On the theory that they're all functionally related, they're all kind of involved in the same process, it's all the same company, all that kind of stuff. But the majority on the Sixth Circuit, it was a 2-1 decision, said that no, adjacent means physical proximity. And if you have wells scattered over what was like a 100-square-mile radius, you know, if you kind of look off all the different directions, they're not adjacent because it wasn't contiguously owned property either. The dissent would have said, no, you can look at a more functional approach and look at things besides physical proximity, but the majority said, no, you can't, and so no deference attaches. Okay, so we've got these three doctrines. You know, agencies are supposed to defer to the scientists. Chevron says that agencies are supposed to defer to Congress when it's clear. When it's not, courts are supposed to defer to agencies. And with respect to regulations, courts are supposed to defer to agency regulations so long as, you know, they're not going against their plain meaning and they're reasonable. Three doctrines which actually end up deciding lots of environmental cases, because the idea is that the person who's making the decision, the judge, is not the best person to do so, quite honestly. That we're going to defer to someone else. Not entirely. Okay, these aren't abdication of the role. But there's certainly a sense in which we're going to let someone else's view carry much more weight, which is broadly consistent with the idea of humility that I've talked about. But it does depend upon kind of judgments about what knowledge and what expertise is relevant. Okay? Technical expertise, it's plain that the agency has more of that than the court. Interpretive expertise, not necessarily so plain. If you see the kind of Chevron as saying that agencies are better interpreters than judges, it doesn't make any sense because judges interpret, that's what they do. If you see Chevron as saying that agencies are entrusted with the policy decisions with respect to a kind of ambiguous statute, then it makes more sense. You don't want the judges making policy. But there's a kind of question about what is it that's going on in those kinds of circumstances, which ultimately is about this kind of underlying question of who do we want to be holding responsible and accountable to making the decisions about what the environment's actually going to be like. So ongoing discussions in the case law in each of these kinds of circumstances. No one expected Chevron to be the kind of huge change in that it proved to be 30 years ago. Whether any of these doctrines will change a little or a lot, we'll have to see. But it plainly is falling all within this framework of who gets to decide. So let me stop there and just open up for any questions.